This podcast is produced by the Center for Deployment Psychology at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government. In addition, references to any specific companies, products, processes, or services does not necessarily constitute or imply endorsement by the Uniformed Services University, the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Hey, listeners, we're trying something new this year. Come join us live on Tuesday, August 13th from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern. We will take questions and stories from you, our listeners.
Maybe you have a question for one of our previous guests, or even about the episode you're listening to today. Do you have a question for us or a great what is your why story? Either way, we want to hear it.
So call in and we'll address your questions and we'll include them in our final episode of the season. And if you can't call on August 13th, automated operators are standing by right now. Send us a voicemail on our SpeakPipe or an email, and all of our contact info will be below.
Can't wait to hear from you.
Welcome to CDP's podcast, Practical for Your Practice,
where we give you actionable intel to support what you do, one colleague to another.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Practical for Your Practice. I am your host, one of your hosts, Dr. Kevin Holloway. I'm joined today by my fabulous co-host, Dr. Jenna Ermold. Hi, Jenna.
Hi, I'm glad I made it to the co-host level there. I was worried when you started with I am your host. I thought maybe I got fired and nobody told me.
No, I just misspoke. So I'm so glad you're here. I couldn't do this myself.
Okay, good. Happy to be here as always.
Of course, fantastic. And we're happy to have our guest today is Dr. Suzanne Strabler. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do? Where are you at?
Yes, so I am broadcasting with you now from New York, and I'm the clinical director of treatment at our Outpatient Eating Disorder Center and Day Program for Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. And related to what we're talking about today, I'm a lead trainer for CBT for eating disorders.
That's fantastic. And probably I'm going to put in a shameless plug early on. Dr. Strabler is going to be doing a two-day CBT for eating disorders training workshop for CDP coming up here later in the summer of 2024. And so we're happy to have you on the podcast to talk about what this is and why it's important and all of that. And we're certainly, of course, excited to have you teaching a workshop for us too.
Great. Thank you. And I can't wait. I've been so excited about this training initiative, the inclusion of eating disorders. It's wonderful. And yeah, looking forward to talking with you both more about it today.
It's such an under-trained area. So we are thrilled that you are helping to fix that as in the little way we can. But one of the things I really wish is that we all, more of us, had good training in EBPs for eating disorders. So thank you for both, for being here today and for stepping in and teaching that as well.
Absolutely. Such an important topic too. Like a lot of our listeners are providers within the Department of Defense, work with service members and family members. And I think sometimes, you know, eating disorders as an issue is sometimes underappreciated in that population too. We often think about, you know, well, people need to make weight and they've got to, you know, do PT and of course they're healthy and strong and built and such. And there's kind of a darker side to that for some people where in order to make weight or to, you know, to meet standards, there can be some unhealthy ways to get there too. So important for this population as well.
Absolutely. And I think the more that sort of military personnel, veterans are looked at now that there is a reduction in shame and stigma with mental health across all disorders, eating disorders is really a particular disorder that, you know, thrives in with military fitness culture, with the amount of people who've experienced trauma, with the stress of being in the military. Those are all of the factors that make one more vulnerable for an eating disorder. And then also what an eating disorder looks like. And as the field begins to change our impressions of that and better understanding body fat composition, which is hugely important in terms of fitness testing for the military, but some of the requirements for that actually can push someone toward disordered eating, if not a full-blown eating disorder. And so we're seeing numbers among military personnel and veterans of eating disorders is really equal to, if not quite a bit higher than the general population. So it's wonderful to be exploring this and to getting training for the providers who are working with military personnel and veterans, especially.
And family members. I think that's another piece that gets forgotten is the, you know, the prevalence of this in families and how stressful it is when you don't have care available, you know, for a child or a spouse or somebody who's also experiencing the stress surrounding that. So just want to lump them into.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you did, Jenna, because that's another area. Yes, it's the children of military personnel who we tend to see having higher numbers of eating disorder presentations as well. And just really, this research is in its infancy in trying to understand prevalence, what's setting someone up to be more vulnerable. And there are a number of different factors. But yeah, looking at families as well and the impact of deployment on that, or just the impact of fitness conversations, which will be happening within families that may be setting up children for being more vulnerable to developing an eating disorder later on.
Yeah, this is tough stuff, right? And like Jenna said, totally undertrained. I'm one of those that fall definitely in the undertrained area. This wasn't a focus in grad school. It wasn't a focus in any of my training locations after grad school, not been part of my experience since. And so I'm certainly part of that group that, you know, is untrained. And I think therefore kind of nervous, kind of, you know, a little overwhelmed if I have a client that's got issues around that. And I feel like that's relatively common. So I'm curious, how did you get into this? Like, what we've been asking all of our guests this season, kind of like their backstory, their origin story, partly because you know, working with any clients can be difficult and challenging at times, and I think especially true with folks with eating disorders. And so, you know, when we face those challenging times, it's really nice sometimes to be reminded of, you know, what is our why? What are we doing here? And so, wondering if you would share with us, like, how did you get into this area, and what is your why?
Yeah, definitely. So when I was an undergrad, we had to write a thesis. And I had this idea that I thought was wonderful, and I was going to explore birth order and mental illness. And I thought this was going to be really interesting. And I made a proposal and presented it to my professor, and they said, "You're not going to find anything on this. This is not a worthwhile topic."
I was hoping you were going to say the firstborns are completely mentally
healthy. Clearly, right?
And everybody,
Club
I
of
think
firstborns
we're both
right
firstborns,
here.
Right?
Yeah, for sure. How such firstborns.
I'm a baby child, but
we probably should have asked before we did that.
I may have brought some other bias to the work. But he said, "Look, there's not really a project in that, so you need to look at something else." And I thought, you know, I'm interested in eating disorders, so maybe I'll explore that a little bit. It was a big piece of abnormal psychology kind of production. So I started, and it didn't take me long to just be totally engrossed in this area. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, eating is part of the foundation. And here is an illness that directly attacks one's ability to nourish themselves, to feed themselves. Then you add in the component of food is so important to our culture, to so many important celebrations. And again, this disorder is taking that away from people, and also the whole physical aspect. You know, I was a big science sort of undergrad major as well as psychology, and this, you know, eating disorders brings that together. It's one of the few psychological illnesses that has such a huge impact on our physical bodies.
Right.
And that sort of brain and body connection was incredibly appealing to me. And that was sort of it. Undergrad, I decided eating disorders is the area that I want to go into. And I made that my focus kind of ever since, and added on more and more trainings as I was doing it, and ultimately ended up in the United Kingdom working with Chris Fairburn and Zafra Cooper, who were the developers for CBT for eating disorders. And I stayed there for the greater part of about 12 or 13 years, working as a trial therapist and really honing my skill in offering these therapies and developing these treatments for eating disorders, and seeing that so many people, when they receive well-implemented therapies, they get well. And it's just so incredible to be a part of that, to be a part of their journey and their story. So to your point, Kevin, if you're worried about working with an individual who has an eating disorder, I'd say that's very, very common. I think eating disorders, they are sort of you want to do it or you're really fearful. But the more we train people, the more comfort we have in having these conversations about what you're eating. Do you engage in behaviors like making yourself vomit or abusing laxatives or diet pills? The less scary that becomes and the more able we are to speak on those things.
I think there is a myth or a misconception out there. Like eating disorders has a bad rap, right? Like it's kind of the an intractable, a really, challenging, difficult to treat. And I love that you are out there trying to break that down, that we do have really fantastic evidence-based care that makes a huge difference. I have like two places I want to go at one time, but one of the things I was struck by as you were talking about like eating disorders as a category, I think again, people tend to kind of go mostly to like one place, like anorexia or bulimia, and it's really a broad category of diet. I mean, there's a lot of diagnoses in there. Can you just take a second to maybe speak to while all, I mean, and maybe this is a question. Do they all have something in common when you talk about treating eating disorders as a category? Presentations can look so different. And I think that's why it's also underevaluated and underdiagnosed because there's this sort of stereotype of what that looks like. But in the real world, that's not how it plays out.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you bring that up. I want to come back to the issue of the stereotype and what we think an eating disorder looks like. But to just backtrack to the first part of what you were saying, yeah, so we have in DSM-5 eight recognized feeding and eating disorders. And for most people, they think we have eight. I had no idea we have that many. And there is something common across all of them, and it's a disturbance to feeding or eating in some capacity. And that's really where the common theme ends, and they all look and appear quite a lot different. The most common ones and the ones that CBT for eating disorders is designed to treat is anorexia nervosa and its subtype, anorexia nervosa, atypical anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and both of them having a sub-threshold category. And I'll come back to that just a second. And then we have this other category, other specified feeding and eating disorders, OSFED, which is actually the majority of eating disorder cases. But within there, we see our atypical anorexia nervosa, our binge eating and bulimia nervosa sub-threshold. And I think for all three of them, it's a poorly defined category. We see individuals with atypical anorexia nervosa, the sub-threshold versions of bulimia nervosa or binge eating disorder, just as unwell as our patients who meet full criteria, if you will, psychosocially just as impaired, physically just as impaired. And it can become really problematic in terms of insurance coverage if you don't have a full eating disorder, as it were. But it can also be really hard for the individual who may feel, oh, I don't have a real eating disorder. And
It's
I've
not
heard
legitimate.
exactly. And I've heard so many individuals I work with say that I don't have a real eating disorder. And then coupled with that, we have this whole issue of the stereotype. And for anyone who's heard me speak about this, it's something that I constantly just bang on about. We had this image that the individuals who got eating disorders were young, white, affluent females. And thankfully, the field has moved on, but a lot of that view is it's still out there. And so we know that eating disorders impact all individuals across races, ages, genders, ethnicities, socioeconomic status, and across body shape and size. And BMI, body mass index, has really harmed us a lot in this way because we can have someone who is on the BMI scale, obese or overweight, and have anorexia nervosa, atypical, but they won't get picked up because in our mind we think, oh my gosh, someone with anorexia nervosa is emaciated and they're extremely underweight. And so we miss out on all of these individuals who have extremely severe eating disorders because of this view that we have and these stereotypes.
I think too, as I'm thinking about stereotypes, one that comes to mind too, I mean, like Jenna mentioned, kind of this idea of intractable, it's really hard to treat. But also, I have this concern that I'm going to say something wrong. I'm going to do something wrong. I'm going to hurt somebody because I'm not as well trained in this. And so it's very validating to hear that we have good therapies, that there is something that can be done. So can you tell us just a little bit about what is CBT for eating disorders? What is it? What are, I don't know, really basically kind of quickly, like what are the, its components? Because I mean, of course, any of our listeners that are interested in the finer details, come to the workshop, come register and learn how to do this. But tell us a little bit about the treatment.
Yeah, definitely come to the workshop. So CBTE actually stands for Enhanced Cognitive Behavior Therapy, and it's a specialist treatment for eating disorders. There are several different types, but the main type and what we'll be talking about in the workshop is the focused version, which is a 20-session treatment that lasts for about 5 months. So it's considered a short-term therapy. And again, when we're, you know, people think of that word intractable. Here is an illness that when the treatment is well implemented, and I cannot stress that enough, which is why I think training is so important, yes. Well implemented CBTE for people who complete it, over 2/3 of patients can make long and lasting recovery. So eating disorders are treatable, especially when the treatment that they receive is a good, well implemented therapy. And so 20 sessions to treat something that may have one time been seen as intractable.
Yeah.
And so what we start with is the first 4 weeks, therapy is actually twice a week. And I've heard a lot of concern from therapists, oh my goodness, we could never bill for twice weekly sessions, or we'll never be able to make that happen. You can do it, definitely. We do it right here in my clinic in New York. I supervise therapists all over the world, but in the United States, we're billing for twice weekly sessions. And it's so important that we get that momentum built right off the ground. We're asking people to change something about their eating, which is really hard. Yeah. We live in this incredibly diet-focused, fitness-focused culture. And here we are going against a lot of these myths about what's the best way to feed our bodies. So twice a week really helps set the groundwork for that. When we do that for about a month, then we meet weekly for about 10 weeks. And then the last stage of treatment, there are 4 stages, we meet about every other week so that we're building in, you can do this on your own to the individual and preventing relapse for them.
I'm going to figure out how I can get signed up for this training too. I'm so excited for it. In terms of like populations, I know you talked about specific, you know, kind of diagnoses that this has been validated with. How about age ranges? Is this okay for adolescents? Does there, you know, what should we be looking for in terms of who is going to benefit most from this?
Yeah, that's an awesome question. So CBTE is transdiagnostic for those main eating disorder categories that I mentioned, but it's also across the ages. So there is a version for adolescents, and then we have the main version for adults, and we've utilized it with individuals who are much older. I've seen patients who are in their 80s and responding Wow. really well to this therapy. And so, yeah, it goes across the ages. We do have another therapy that has a very good evidence base for, particularly for restrictive type eating disorders in adolescents, called family-based treatment. And CBTE is considered an alternate treatment in that group. But for adults 18 and up, all the way to end of life, CBTE is the frontline treatment, particularly for eating disorders that have binge eating as a part of the illness. So binge eating disorder, bulimia nervosa, and their subgroups.
I love that you mentioned CBTE. In my head, that's been CBT for eating disorders. You said that it's CBT enhanced. And so I guess I'm curious to know a little bit about that. What are some of the things that make this enhanced, perhaps? And maybe if it's related, maybe this is a different question, but what are some of the challenges that a therapist needs to anticipate or be prepared for in offering CBTE, enhanced CBT? And I ask that partly because probably a lot of us, most of our listeners, are trained in CBT, basic CBT. And so similarities, differences, challenges are kind of where my brain is going that I wanted to ask you about.
Let me see if I can hold on to all of those questions and let me know if not. You know, I've always sort of spoken with Chris and Zafra, and I said, you know, everybody thinks that the E stands for eating disorders.
Right.
I really think that is what you should have named it. Why did you go with the enhanced at the front? I think it's confused everyone. And so, you know, their thinking is they first developed CBT for bulimia nervosa. Then together with Raj Shafran, they looked at all of the cases that did not do well in some of their big randomized controlled trials for bulimia nervosa. And they wanted to make the treatment for individuals who were lower in weight, higher in weights. They wanted to add some additional components to target some of the eating disorder behaviors that we see related to body shape and weight checking, body shape and weight avoidance behaviors. And so in their minds, they enhanced the CBT for bulimia nervosa. And that's why they went with that name. To your point, though, Kevin, about how is this different to other CBTs, I have to say it is very different. But to all of your listeners, don't let that put you off. But I do think, you know, I am a certified CBT therapist. And in terms of CBTE, compared to the other CBTs, it is really quite a lot different. We're not doing the whole ABC triangle and talking about that particular vicious cycle. I would say it's almost behavioral cognitive therapy. So in that first stage where we're meeting twice a week, we are really focused on helping an individual adopt a regular pattern of eating, feeding our bodies at regular intervals, which is one of the most potent interventions that we have. And if we can do that well and we can do it right, it really does often predict later outcome in treatment. So helping someone to feed their body at intervals, but then also to feed their body enough. We have plenty of individuals with eating disorders who may not be low weight according to BMI, as it were, but they are lower in weight than their body optimally needs, or they're under fat. And I use that term to describe someone whose body fat composition is not where their body needs it to be. And we have different percentages of body fat and what's ideal and what's quote unquote the most healthy. But we're all different, and health looks different on all of our bodies. And a body fat percentage that may be healthy for some person may not be the body fat percentage that's most healthy for me. So we're behaviors, we're changing the behavior of eating, the pattern of eating, the content of the eating. And then we start to work on a lot more of the cognitions, the thoughts about one's shape, one's weight, the intense body dissatisfaction that we really see across many of our patients. And we work on that behaviorally as well, but we're really targeting those cognitions kind of second after we've repaired nutrition, after we've repaired body weight, body fat.
So kind of like that strong exposure component up front, it sounds like. I mean, behavioral experiments, you know, getting the body to have the nutrients it needs, refeeding is sort of the focus initially, depending on the presentation. And then you get to some of the heart, the cognitive shifts after that.
Absolutely. And I would say behaviorally changing someone's pattern of eating is across the board. That's for someone who is significantly lower in weight than their body needs, but also somebody who is not at all. Because for many people with eating disorders, they are not feeding their body at regular intervals. They are engaging in all kinds of dieting behaviors, maybe eating as late in the day as possible, or having periods of fasting, or underfeeding their body just calorically throughout the day. And it's really hard to change our thinking until our bodies are nourished, until our brains are getting sustained calories and energy throughout the day. And so that's why we kind of delay some of that cognitive work until after those things are more settled and in place.
That makes a ton of sense. One of the other things that we always include in our podcast is something we call actionable intel. So it would be amazing if we could, you know, soup to nuts, teach everybody CBTE on the podcast, but that's impossible. But we do want to encourage people to either take next steps or know about resources, or what's something that they could change in their practice tomorrow as it relates to eating disorders, and wondered if you had a few pieces of actionable intel that you might share with our listeners to keep going on this journey.
Absolutely. I would say the first thing is eating disorders and disordered eating are so comorbid. so that if you are working in mental health or primary care, please assess your patients for eating disorders. We have a number of really quick 5-question assessments. Some are better than others, but check with your patients. Don't be afraid to ask these questions. If someone is undernourishing their body and they also take antidepressant medication, the medications may not work as well. If someone is undernourishing their body and they're experiencing intense emotional dysregulation, not that nourishing will totally take that away, but it may make them better able to access the other therapy that they are doing. So I think after the show, you're going to put some links to some of these measures, but ask your patients, do a quick questionnaire, see what you find. The more we ask these questions, the more we're seeing a lot of comorbidity, someone coming in for mood disorder, but there's an underlying eating disorder or disordered eating there. So I'd say that's point one, ask the questions, don't be afraid to ask them. And then the second thing I would really say is in terms of challenging the myth of who has an eating disorder, I think we also need to tackle and question our own weight bias, our own weight stigmatizing thoughts that we may have, educating ourselves on what weight bias is, what weight stigma is, what that looks like. We know that individuals in mental health, but eating disorder specialists as well, hold a tremendous amount of weight bias. And weight bias being this idea that, you know, a thin body or a fit body, whatever the cultural ideal for body shape and weight is where you are, is achievable. And that those who don't achieve it, there is something not right with them. They're morally inferior in some way. And for many of us, we hold these biases internal. We may not even be aware of it, but we need to learn about it. We need to question ourselves, to check these things. And so I would say that's point two. Check in with yourself. Do you have any of these biases internal to yourself? Are you accidentally increasing weight stigma in your patients with things you may be thinking or saying? So I think that's the second area.
I love that because one thought that keeps coming to me is that I think part of my own weight bias, and maybe others share this too, is that sometimes there's this feeling like eating disorders is within the client's control more perhaps than other mental health, behavioral health issues. And ironically, at the same time, so many of these are about a sense of either, not having control or about the need to over control. And it's an interesting dialectic there that on the one hand, we kind of assume people have so much control. And on the other hand, control is kind of a central issue, and it's not that they just are making choices intentionally to have these issues. So,
absolutely, and I think the more bias in whatever form it takes, but I'm very focused on weight bias. Just being open to thinking about these things may be uncomfortable, and we may discover things about ourselves that we don't quite like, and that's opportunity for education and for learning and for changing and to question this idea of, does someone have control over their body shape and weight? Most of our body shape and weight is predetermined by genetics. There's some stuff we can do to move the weight number or the size number a little bit, but nowhere near as much as diet culture would encourage us to believe that we have control over that. So questioning those things, I think, is so important, and wondering about just internalized dieting myths that we have all internalized. Good foods, bad foods,
quote, labels, unquote,
healthy foods, unhealthy foods.
Which changes depending on the month and the year, Eat this, don't eat that. Now don't eat this, now eat that. And you can't even keep up.
Absolutely. We are inundated with this messaging. And if someone is vulnerable to an eating disorder, it's hard to not pay attention to that messaging. We all hear it.
Right.
And so if you are set up for developing an eating disorder because of past trauma or stress in your life, or just thoughts and messaging you received as a child, or pressure to make weight, those are the things that are going to kind of really cause an eating disorder to develop.
And then maybe a third one that we've mentioned a few times is, another opportunity is seek opportunities for training and to learn more. And so, of course, one possible opportunity for training is this upcoming 2-day workshop in CBTE that Dr. Strabler will be presenting for CDP. Now, if you're hearing this recording after the fact, like after it's August 2024, and we're going to have this initial workshop, I will tell you, we you know, we're interested in doing this more than once. So, you know, look for those opportunities. We'll have some links and information in the show notes about other kinds of training, the ones here, but also maybe others that Dr. Schaebler, you can provide, or and links to resources. So look for those in the show notes too.
Absolutely.
Well, I am I'm so excited that you will be working with CDP. I am excited to attend the workshop. I appreciate the time that you took today to meet and speak with us. I'm just going to summarize real fast the actionable intel. One is ask the questions, assess, and you know, find out. Again, we're going to link them in the show notes, but there's some great short questionnaires you can include in your assessment and maybe even in your paperwork, but ask the question. Acknowledging our own weight bias, maybe doing some evaluation with ourselves about biases, beliefs, and assumptions we have around bodies and weights and even types of eating, and seek out some additional training, whether that's through CDP. We'll hopefully, you know, add a link to some other resources that you would guide folks to. But definitely don't avoid it. Don't think of it as somebody else's thing. It's really a presentation and a challenge and a diagnosis that we all should be able to, if not treat, know where to send somebody to get evidence-based care. So I think that's another important thing, is when do I need to refer and where, and what would that look like? So I'm just thrilled to meet you. I'm excited to get to know you more and hear more from you. And I'm glad that the what is your why led you down this path, and you didn't study us firstborns, which is probably a lot more fun, because you know we're difficult, not like the youngest child who are just flexible and easygoing.
That was a great recovery.
You're like, that, see what I did there? I brought it full circle and made Suzanne feel better for being the best amongst us.
Well, thank you so much. It's really been brilliant. The whole training initiative, you know, it's just such a wonderful initiative. And I think it's great that eating disorders is getting focused. Of course, I think that that's my bias. But truly, these illnesses are treatable. Training is available. And we really need to train ourselves and offer the best evidence that we can to the individuals who are suffering so that they can reach their long-lasting recoveries.
So well said. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you all to our listeners for listening. We appreciate you being here and learning along with us. We'll talk to you soon in another episode.
Bye. Thanks for listening to Practical for Your Practice.
Please feel free to subscribe, like, and share.
Until next time.